Well, welcome to another Power Talk interview. And today I'm extremely excited to share with you a genius, a man who's a legend. He would argue with those titles, I'm sure. But that's Mr. Norman Cousins. He's the author of over 20 books, including The Healing Heart, The Pathology of Power, and his latest book is called Head First, The Biology of Hope. And I want to definitely get him to share some of those distinctions with you today. You probably know Norman from Anatomy of an Illness. It's his most famous book, chronicling basically what happened in his life and the distinctions he made about how emotions could affect biochemistry. And in addition to that, you probably have known him because he was the editor of Saturday Review from 1940 to 1971. Currently, he is the adjunct professor at the School of Medicine here at UCLA. And if you hear some noises and rattling, Norman's taken time in between his classes to visit with us here for an hour, and I'm really appreciative of it. And he's also a board member for the Center of Health Communication at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Institute of Advancement of Health. And since coming to UCLA, basically he's begun to share and research and back up the distinctions that he made with himself and with others throughout the years. And I'm really privileged to be with you here, Norman. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Tony.
We first met years ago, almost 7 years ago, when Dr. Carl Symington, the cancer researcher, introduced us. And then you attended my firewalk seminar way back then, which you wrote about. It was interesting to hear your distinctions.
Was that 7 years ago?
Yeah. Well, listen, I wanted to start out, if I may, by asking you to... Most people know a lot about you, but let's start, if you wouldn't, give us the genesis of your present work. I mean, you're really one of the moving forces and the people are making the difference in the new science, relatively new science, of psychoneuroimmunology. Where did it all start for you?
Probably was prenatal, Tony.
I believe that.
we all have experiences that go back pretty far.
Yeah, this is true.
And I'm not sure I can access mine, but I think that the sum total of your life, even though you may not be able to identify all the parts, probably figures in the answer to your question. I'm not sure I know where it starts. I certainly don't know where it's going to end.
Well, we were talking earlier, and Norm was saying he was 75, and I said, how old are you going to be? And his answer was, when I do what, which I love. Well, I guess I'm pointing you in the direction of, I remember reading in one of your books about at the age of 10, you were misdiagnosed as having tuberculosis, I believe, and while you were there, it sounds like you made some distinctions that affected your ability to become more healthy more rapidly.
Yes, I was sent to a TB sanatorium and learned a great deal there. It was a powerful educational experience to be with youngsters, some of whom know they're facing death, and some of whom may not be, but believe they're going to be,
right,
and how that holds them back and or pushes them in the wrong direction.
Right.
One's philosophy of life, it seems to me, tend to be shaped by rather stark events.
Yes.
That was a rather interesting time in my life. For a long time, I tried not to talk about it because of the stigma that is attached to tuberculosis. But after a while, you recognize that's a little silly, especially when there are enough years between that event where you are now to testify to the fact that you're completely cured.
Right. I remember you reading about you talking about how at that time even you made a distinction, and that was you joined what I think you called the Cheerful Brigade. Maybe you could amplify him on that.
Yes. By and large, the kids at the TB Sanatorium were divided into two groups. Those who were conscious of their illness tended to dwell on the deaths of their friends at the sanatorium, and tended to be resigned. Certainly they were rather defeatist. And then there were those who planned and plotted to get out as though this were a prison. And were absolutely certain they were going to get out. And by and large, these kids moved along the path of their expectations. That was an important lesson for me. And it does serve to, I think, underline one of the most important things we can learn to life in life, namely that we do tend to move on the path of our expectations.
And that includes physical health as well as anything else.
That's right.
Well, at 39, I believe, is when you were told that you had a coronary occlusion, and you were, basically, your doctor told you should suspend all normal activities. Now, the next day, you went out and played, you know, 50 games of tennis. So,
Well, what happened was that this was the result of an insurance examination, and I was turned down on the examination by the insurance doctors because they said there was evidence of a silent coronary. And my aunt, who is the insurance agent, said she had a very frank talk with the doctors, and she was sobbing as she told me this. She said they feel that you, that if you're very careful, take to bed and rest a great deal, you may have a year to 18 months.
A death sentence.
And
they call that pointing the bone in some cultures, don't they?
Right.
By the witch
so
doctor.
It could have been a hex if you want to take it as such. But you had a choice whether to believe the insurance doctors or not to believe them.
Yes.
And it was a happy choice for me that I made. And the next day I went out and played several sets of tennis singles as hard as I could without any symptoms. And a few months later, Paul Dudley White, the great cardiologist, told me I had done what I had to do to save my life, which is that if I had accepted the diagnosis, the inactivity itself would have been destructive.
Exactly.
The body needs to be worked. And he said that a lot of people have silent heart attacks, and you're going to get over yours, but you're going to get over it by doing what you're doing, which is not to let it defeat you or deflect you, and also to have regular exercise. He's watched your diet, and well, that was now 36 years ago.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Now, what made you not listen to the doctors? As you say, to listen to it, you said it with a little snideness in your voice, but to listen to the insurance doctors or not, so many people, doctors are people we look to. They're basically the people that guide us when we're ill. For most of us in our culture, we're conditioned. Was it because you were misdiagnosed when you were 10? What gave you the references?
I think that the particular diagnosis that I was given at the time was probably justified in terms of what the test showed.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is that a prognosis tends to be based on statistics rather than on the particular case before you.
Right.
Statistics represent lows and highs. Therefore, I think it's a mistake just to assume that you're in the ominous division. In any event, the big thing in life is to get the most out of whatever is possible. And if you settle for less than is possible, it's going to happen sooner than you think.
Seems like a guiding principle you've lived your life by, to always find out more of what's possible. What role did your daughter, I remember reading something about your daughter and thinking about her, what role did that play in your decision making? You recall what I'm talking about? I think you mentioned in some of your writings that you're thinking about not being with your daughter or not living fully with your daughter was one of the things that pushed you to say, I'm going to go play tennis, I'm going to live while I'm here.
Oh, yes. Well, I've got a lot of daughters.
I'm sorry.
And it's also a wonderful family.
Right.
My wife is not just a wife, but a very good friend.
That's wonderful.
And I had a lot of pleasant things to keep me going, I suppose.
Right.
And to look forward to.
That's pretty important, and having hope, I assume.
Yes.
What gave you the idea to go out and play these tapes and laugh your way into health?
Oh, well, this particular episode occurred in an illness following a trip to the Soviet Union. We were involved then in cultural exchange negotiations, and I was the chairman. It meant that there was a great deal of homework I had to do. The hotel room was very close to a housing project under round-the-clock construction, and diesel trucks would ply back and forth to that project all night, and it was July. The hotel window was open because it was warm, and I think there were a lot of black hydrocarbons that were there to be breathed in. And by the time I got back to the States, I was feeling pains in my bones and some fever.
Right.
When they made a rather somber diagnosis, not being able to identify the cause, I naturally thought of this experience, and it seemed to me that in any illness, and in treating the illness, one of the most important things you do is to identify the cause and then reverse the cause. Otherwise, you're just chasing the effects.
Right.
And it seemed to me that if the combination of the emotional strain of the meetings plus the exposure to those black hydrocarbons, if 20 degree, that combination was involved in the illness, then the thing to do was to reverse it. The reversal of the negative emotions cause positive emotions. The reversal of the exposure to the toxicity calls for anti-toxic measures. And the body is not without its own mechanisms for dealing with toxicity. And so I proceed along that track. On the emotional side, it seemed to me that love, hope, faith, will to live, festivity, the opposite of some of the exasperation, frustration, rage, and so forth. And that was why it seemed to me that laughter was one of the most specific things you could do. And so I brought into my hospital room films of very funny movies. And Alan Funt supplied me with films of candid camera. And I had myself one hell of a time.
Not the normal environment one goes to the hospital in.
But the patients in 303 and 304 didn't think that all this raucous noise was very funny. And so I moved my act to a hotel room where I made the very interesting discovery that I would get twice as much sleep at half the price.
So that's why you left the hospital. Amazing.
But my doctor proved this. We could set up the intravenous and everything else that they needed and had nursing. One thing I didn't have was interruptions.
Very nice.
Constant interruptions, which you frequently get in hospitals.
Right. Who was your doctor at that time, and what role did he play in your distinctions and being willing to trust yourself?
Well, I give my doctor, Dr. Bill Hitzig, primary credit. He was treating not just a disease, he was treating an individual.
Right.
He began with a knowledge of the person, and then he added the knowledge of medicine to that. Unfortunately, in too many cases, there is you treat the disease and not the individual.
Right.
Or the doctor may know more about the disease than he does about the individual who has the disease. Bill Hitzig was really a great physician. He's deceased since. He was a good listener, and he gave you the feeling that he was trying to find out exactly what was wrong by listening very carefully. He didn't push you into the tests as the first recourse.
Right.
He didn't try to establish a diagnosis just based on what the tests were going to show. He came to his own determination, and then he used the tests to confirm and not to establish. And above all, he recognized that the role of the doctor was to reassure, because unless there is that fundamental reassurance, unless the patient does have some hope that something good can happen, the environment of treatment is impaired.
I agree. I remember reading an article talking about the effect of drugs and talking with Dr. Andrew Weil, where he talked about that it was really the physician's belief in the effect of the drugs that played the biggest role. He demonstrated that he could take people and give them amphetamines and tell them they were barbiturates, and their body would literally slow down, even though they'd been given a physical drug to speed up, and vice versa. What's your belief about the effect and importance of drugs versus the effect of one's individual belief systems on oneself and healing?
There are some drugs which can represent the difference between life and death.
I agree.
If, for example, I had an infection of the valves of the heart, a bacterial endocarditis, an antibiotic could save my life. But even as you say that, you want to create the optimum environment for that to take place. You want the patient to program himself or herself for a good result.
Right.
But there are countless numbers of drugs, however, that are not really necessary. 85% of our illnesses are self-limiting, which is to say that without doing anything, the body will take care of its needs. Given reassurance, emotional calm, a sense of confidence, a certain sense of joy, and a strong will to live, and that's part of the doctor's job. Unfortunately, doctors tend to be rather busy. And there's a curious notion that's fostered that the only thing the doctor can do with any illness is to prescribe medicine or surgery. And I don't think the doctor realizes how wide are the range of powers and options open to him or her. That the doctor's job or doctor's power is not confined to the prescription pad. The most important thing a doctor can do is to find out what the circumstances were that preceded the illness, not just to identify a bug or a virus and then say, here's the particular antibiotic we need for that. There are many illnesses that don't involve drugs, don't involve bugs, rather, or viruses. But even when they do, it's important for the doctor to understand what the circumstances were that may have contributed to the illness. Why didn't the healing system work in this particular
case?
What is required to put the healing system back in shape again? That is primary. Drugs are secondary.
Right.
And only when determination is made that the extent of a problem is beyond the reach of the body to solve are you justified in going in for these exotic drugs. These can be very dangerous. I saw a figure recently that 30% of all hospital beds were occupied for iatrogenic reasons, causes that were connected to treatment, most of them having to do with drugs. The most frequently prescribed drug in the United States is Valium. Last year, some 60 million prescriptions were written for Valium. Drugs like these, tranquilizers, mood-altering drugs, can be very dangerous. They can affect the nervous system.
Prozac being one of the big ones right now.
Prozac especially, yes. That's come under fire recently. I've seen patients who have been misdiagnosed as having Parkinson's disease because of tremors of hands, head, and feet, whereas those tremors were caused not by Parkinson's, but by these tranquilizers or mood-altering drugs. Once you took them, the patients off these drugs very carefully because they're addictive, you take them over very carefully, you discover that the tremors would recede and disappear. But those tremors can be very serious, not just in themselves, but because they can be misdiagnosed and then the patient treated for something else.
Right. Well, I remember reading Dr. Henry Beecher, I think from Harvard, did an article where he talked about how a person responds to placebos most often when they're most fearful, when they have the most anxiety, which those who study anything about hypnotic patterns know that a person is most suggestible in those states. So it appears that a doctor has more power than he realizes than the drug, in that, if I'm quoting him accurately, I wrote it down for the interview, he said that any drug's usefulness, quote, is a direct result of not only the chemical properties of the drugs, but also the patient's belief in the usefulness and effectiveness of the drug.
When you refer to the placebo as evidence of that, and I'm not sure that we have learned as much as we should from the placebo.
Right.
Or how expectations about a drug are converted into physiological reality. I have in mind, for example, an experiment about placebos in which you had about 100 medical students who were asked to participate in testing two new drugs. One was described as a super stimulant contained in a red capsule. The other was described as a super tranquilizer contained in a blue capsule. And they described the chemical ingredients of each drug, as well as the effects that they would produce, some of which would be pretty severe in addition to the benefits. Now, the only difference between this particular experiment and most placebo experiments is that there were the actual ingredients, the pharmacological properties in these capsules. The only thing that was different, and that the medical students were not told, was that the contents of the pills were switched.
Right.
So that the students who took the tranquilize with a blue pill, expecting certain side effects in addition to certain benefits, and the students who took the red pill, expecting that they'd be able to work more efficiently over and stay up for many hours, as well as to experience side effects, did not know that they were taking exactly the opposite pill. Yet 50% of the students had the physiological reactions that went with their expectations. In short, their bodies had to go through a contrary provocation to get at the point of expectation, which proves that mind is more powerful than medicine. In England recently, they were testing a new form of chemotherapy. This was explained to patients, they were told that there'd be a rather severe hair fall out, but the hair would grow back in again, some of the other effects. And they used a placebo as well with other cancer patients, nothing but an innocuous sugar pill. The interesting thing was that 50% of the people who took that sugar pill experienced severe hair fallout.
Amazing.
Now, opposite that, you had the experience in the United States of minoxidil. You've probably seen the advertisements for this,
sure. A
hair-growing substance. And here, too, they had to test this against a placebo. And again, a considerable number of patients who took an innocent pill, thinking it was a hair-growing pill. Men who were bald, who took this innocent pill, grew hair.
Sounds like the faith of the mustard seed, you know, quote, sounds to be physically real for people.
Yes, our bodies are apothecaries, you see, and we convert our expectations into chemical reality.
How do we do that? Do we understand that yet?
Yes, increasingly, I think we're beginning to identify the pathways, how the brain processes ideas, how there's a conversation, for example, between the brain and the immune system and the endocrine system, the workings of peptides, the neurotransmitters and the receptors, vast armies moving in different directions, all being coordinated to be sure. And so we're beginning to now understand how the brain, which is the most magnificent but also most complex instrument in the universe, works. And we're only beginning to understand how to use that knowledge in combating disease.